This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We rely on computer algorithms, if you think about it, for just about everything. They help us figure out what music we like, who we should date. They can influence who gets accepted into college, who gets fired from their job or even hired. And of course, they're at the center of the future of driverless cars. Now, that's a lot of power for a computer algorithm to hold. And if something goes wrong, well, the results can range from mildly annoying to utter disaster. Take, for example, the Air France flight that was brought down by an autopilot failure in 2009. Was an algorithm legally responsible for such a tragedy? Perhaps not. But as my next guest says, that doesn't mean nothing can be done about it. He's proposed a regulatory body called a National Algorithm Safety Board, which would provide oversight for high-stakes algorithms. And he joins me today to discuss it. Ben Schneiderman is professor of computer science at the University of Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here, Ira. Thank you.
Where do things stand right now? If an algorithm fails and does some sort of harm, can the developers be held responsible for that technology the way that, like, machine manufacturers are?
That's what we'd like to see. That's the right idea, Ira. And yet, most software contracts hold harmless. It means that the developers are not reliable and responsible, or the software is delivered as is. And those terms and contracts mean that there is not sufficiently clear liability for those failures. And I think that's what's going to have to change. And I'm looking for those changes in contracts, but also changes in the way algorithms that are widely used and have potential for damage could be reviewed before they're implemented, like zoning boards review house plans before they're built. And then when you go build a house, the inspector comes by and gives you a certificate of occupancy. It's a common notion to have some kind of independent oversight for large projects where safety is involved, where you want to make sure the builder uses safe materials to prevent fire that's strong enough to support the weight that's necessary. So there are building codes, and we've come over the years to agree on the ways in which buildings should be built. And I think we need to begin to move down that path. It'll take a decade or more till those kind of rules are developed for different industries, but I think that's where we want to go. It's time to move out of the adolescent phase of software engineering after 50 years of this adolescence where hold harmless remains the tradition. It's time to move on to take responsibility. So I'm after increasing the levels of automation, but ensuring as much as possible that safety rules are adhered to.
When you say take responsibility, are you saying that people should be given more responsibility for anything going wrong rather than the hardware?
Not just more responsibility, but clarify that all responsibility inheres in the humans, whether it's the developers of the programs and the software and the algorithms, or the company who sold it, or those who operate it. There's a chain, a complex chain, but we know, as you started out and saying, in manufacturing or aircraft, we know that there are designers, producers, and operators, and when a disaster happens, we know how to look for that. So existing liability law is probably good enough, my lawyer friends tell me, but we need to put that in place. And so the first part of it is the planning oversight, but when there are disasters, we want to have the kind of retrospective analysis of these disasters, like the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, does. And that way there would be public and independent reviews that could be read by everyone with recommendations for improvements.
Well, where would you put responsibility for software that gets hacked? I mean, more and more, you know, we hear stories now about even hacking the new driverless car software. We know about hacking electoral systems. If something gets hacked, who's responsible for that?
Pretty terrible things. Well, the person who did the hacking might be one candidate, but those who made the software with insufficient protection also may have some liability. So we need to set some standards so we know if those who develop the software, and software developers would like this as well, to know if they're protected because they've done the right thing. I think the insurance companies will be our friends in this process, as they have been for buildings and other major constructions, and they will push for safer conditions for all of us to use these algorithms. I want to ensure human control while increasing the level of automation. That's how I think we're going to get to quality.
Are we getting to the point where we're giving too much credit to artificial intelligence or robots as being equal in controlling what goes on? I know you...
Bravo. You bet. You bet. That's been a long-term pursuit of mine, that I do think the ideas that I suggested that machines are becoming our partners and our collaborators and we're working together with them as equals is preposterous and, let me say, misleading and dangerous. And for me, computers are no more intelligent than a wooden pencil. We pick up the pencil and we use it. We're responsible for what we do with the pencil. Computers are more powerful, more complex, but still, human responsibility and human creativity is what drives the world forward.
Would that mean maybe perhaps going backwards a little, taking a step back from automation? Let me think out loud, for example, like the voting system. We have electronic voting. To make it completely unhackable or more unhackable, why not just go backwards to paper where everybody's doing the paper and there's no way to get into the machine?
Sure. The studies about electronic voting machines do favor some kind of paper trail, but the advantages of electronic systems are strong, and that's why they've propagated. But not all electronic systems get designed properly on the first go-round. You know, let's take the case of airbags. They save about 2,500 lives a year, but in the beginning, they inadvertently killed about 100 children and others a year. And the design was insufficient. And so the improved designs made them safer. And I think that's what we have to learn, how to make safe technologies that can be used widely. Similarly, for the case you mentioned of driverless cars, that's going to be a major issue. And we need to ensure that those who promote self-driving cars are also going to take responsibility for the times when they fail. I think inevitably they can be safer than the current systems because this increased levels of automation is what I'm advocating while ensuring human control.
Well, your National Algorithm Safety Board, would it have teeth to enforce or make rulings about the safety of algorithms that come before it?
Exactly, the right question. So there's a variety of things. I've studied independent oversight methods, and you want to have sufficient teeth to carry out investigations of failures, for example, possibly subpoena power. You want to have open and transparent processes by which they conduct their investigations, and then you want public reports to present this in an open way that others can critique or discuss it. The question then is whether their recommendations are enforceable, and what ways are they enforceable? So the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, provides one model. It's wisely been set up by Congress to be independent of any government agency. It's funded separately because often the NTSB investigates the work of different government agencies. And so they've become a respected source for doing these investigations and presenting the results and then making recommendations about the maintenance of aircraft, their improved design, and so on. So we can learn a lot if these processes get to be made more open.
So are the tech developers on board with this idea too?
It's a mixed story. We're still in the early days of this, but you can see that there are major companies that recognize the problem. The five major companies that are involved in partnerships on AI just a few months ago started this group that would address these issues in a much more substantive way. I'm encouraged by that. I'm encouraged by the fact that starting in November, a number of conferences in the artificial intelligence and machine learning world began to address this issue of explainable algorithms, explainable AI. I'm encouraged that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has started a program on explainable AI with 11 projects going forward. So there are good indicators that this issue has risen to public awareness and that people in the technology field, public policy, and elsewhere are putting forward proposals, developing technical solutions. Just look, the simple idea of the way we expect a flight data recorder to record the details of an aircraft's flight. And yet we have no standards or ways in which a computer algorithm would log its usage. And we don't have the tools yet that would allow you to examine a million or a billion lines of such a log in a way that would help reveal the patterns of right. what happened and what went wrong.
Let me take a quick question because we're running out of time, and I want to go to David in South Bend. Quickly, David.
My question is, what instead of a regulatory commission, what about a society that would govern the standards of the industry? Kind of like, I'm a nurse, so I go by the AORN standards of practice. So what would, why wouldn't that type of thing be useful for them? Like, they would get a certification saying that they meet the qualifications on risk analysis and
go ahead. I got about a minute.
That's a reasonable proposal as well. But I just want to mention that the NTSB is not a regulatory agency. Its function currently is investigative of failures. And that alone seems one reasonable route. Now, what I advocated earlier, the planning oversight, that has, like zoning boards that we're so familiar with, that has usually interpreted as a regulatory approach. So that gets you closer to the idea of regulation. But remember, NTSB-like organizations could be valuable just for their investigative and retrospective reviews.
All right, Ben, thank you. I'm sorry we've run out of time. Very interesting. Ben Schneiderman, professor of computer science, University of Maryland. After the break, we're going to talk to biochemist Jennifer Doudna, one of the creators of CRISPR. She has a new book out called The Crack of Creation, and she'll talk about CRISPR and how it got started and the implications, the ethics. There's a lot to talk about here. 844-724-8255 if you want to talk to her. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break with Jennifer Doudna. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. These days, if there's a conversation about gene editing, it's usually talking about CRISPR. The technique has become synonymous with gene editing. CRISPR allows scientists to easily cut and replace DNA sequences, a trick they learned from studying bacteria and how they fight off viruses. Labs around the world are using CRISPR to investigate everything from creating better growing crops to developing treatments for diseases like cancer and Parkinson's to editing out the genes for diseases in embryos. CRISPR as a tool has only been around since 2012. That's like 5 years. And along with opening up the science, CRISPR has brought up questions about the ethics of how we should use such a powerful tool. Like, how much hacking of the human genome would be wise? How is CRISPR developed? What therapeutic uses are the most promising? And how much do we really know about how it works? And where do we draw the ethical lines? My next guest was one of the authors on that original study published in 2012 that described the CRISPR-Cas9 system, as it's known formally. And she's one of the main pioneers of CRISPR. She's here to give us her take and here with a new book. Jennifer Doudna is professor of chemistry and molecular and cell biology, UC Berkeley. She's also co-author of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. She joins us by Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. Tell us why CRISPR is so much easier to use than the editing tools we've already had. Give us a quick idea how it works, what makes it unique.
Well, you can think about it almost like a pair of scissors for DNA in the cell. And the great thing about this tool is that it's programmable. So scientists can directly tell the scissors where to go in the cell, which piece of DNA to cut, and can do that relatively inexpensively and quickly. So it's become a very widespread technology for altering the DNA in virtually all types of cells.
You've had sort of an evolving feeling about the use of CRISPR, have you not?
Very much so, yes. We discussed that in A Crack in Creation, our book. It's a book co-written with a former graduate student of mine, Sam Sternberg, and we wanted to write about sort of personal reflections on the development of this field and my own evolving thoughts about this technology. Of course, I'm an optimist, of course. I'm very excited about the potential for this to do great things in the future, but I think it's a powerful tool that really requires careful thought about its use in various settings.
Yeah, I want to get into that. Let me give out our number first, 844-724-8255 for people who'd like to talk about this. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let's go back a little bit in time about the first time you heard about CRISPR. You heard it from a geomicrobiologist, Jillian Banfield?
That's right.
What was the overlap there that brought you two together?
Well, this is one of the great things about being at a university like University of California, Berkeley, where I work. It's a place that has a fantastic group of people working on all sorts of interesting problems. And Jillian Banfield's lab has long studied natural microbes in their environmental settings. And her research had uncovered many examples of the sequences in DNA that we refer to as CRISPRs. This was back before it was clear what they did biologically. But she had an inkling that they might be working as some sort of adaptive immune system, an idea that a few other scientists had been floating around in the scientific literature at the time. And so she contacted me as a biochemist to see if we might like to investigate this and figure out how these systems might work.
So CRISPR actually was sort of invented by bacteria to fend off viruses, and you guys figured out how to use it to edit genomes.
It's a great story of how I think, curiosity-driven research aimed in one direction ended up uncovering something that could be employed in a completely different way. I think that, the way that bacteria can program proteins to cut viral DNA and protect themselves from viral infection was the original work that we were doing. And this was a project, international collaboration with Emmanuelle Charpentier and her laboratory. But that uncovered the mechanism that we realized could be employed in a very different way, namely for gene editing.
Mm-hmm. And it moved pretty quickly, this idea. It went right into the gene editing community, did it not?
It did, and I think this really speaks to the way that technologies come along, and there's sort of a very important timing aspect to technologies, and I would say that's true for gene editing. It was a tool that was, very much the scientific community was ready for. We needed a way to manipulate DNA in cells, given all of the DNA sequencing that's going on now, and whole genomes being sequenced, and more and more information about the content of genomes. And what was missing was a way to rewrite them, a way to manipulate that information. And when that tool became available, as you pointed out, it was very quickly adopted globally.
In your book, and in case you just joined us, we're talking with Jennifer Doudna about A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. The title itself, Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution, implies, and you say so as much in your book, is that we are now in a stage of human evolution where we can control human evolution. Is that not a fear and awe-inspiring thought?
Well, it certainly is for me. I think, the understanding that we now, as human beings, can control the DNA that makes us who we are and change it in the future, and change the DNA of other organisms in our environment in the same way. It's a really a profound thing to think about, and I think it really opens up both opportunities and risks.
Because you say that, I'm going to quote from your book, that we are unprepared for such colossal responsibility, I have no doubt, but we cannot avoid it. If controlling our genetic destiny is a terrifying thought, then consider the consequences of having this power but not managing to control it. That would be truly terrifying, truly unthinkable.
Yeah.
So you're basically saying people talk about the ethical responsibilities of using it correctly or making sure we don't use it incorrectly. But on the other hand, there's also the ethical choice of having such a powerful tool to cure people with debilitating genetic diseases and not using it.
That's right. I think it's an interesting situation where, you know, we have this tool and we sort of as the scientific community can begin to see how it could be used for incredible things like, you know, curing what were previously incurable genetic diseases. This would be an amazing thing to be able to do. At the same time, it's also a technology that enables making heritable changes to the human germline. That means making changes to DNA that could be inherited by future generations.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you also talk about CRISPR, at least in the original version of it, found in bacteria, is not an entirely error-free method of targeting and cutting DNA. And there was a study out last week in Nature Methods that found thousands of off-target mutations in mice that seemed to say, you know, wait a minute, CRISPR may not be as benign as we think it might be in the creating these mutations. What's your feeling about those studies?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, the general question of how accurate is this technology is a very important one, especially when we think about using it in human beings. I can say that, you know, from the large number of studies that have been done prior to this work that you just cited that appeared in the literature last week, there's been a lot of evidence that this is actually quite a remarkably good technology in terms of accuracy. It's not perfect, nothing is, but I think it's really quite good at finding the correct DNA sequence, mm-hmm. the desired sequence, and making a change. Now, the study that you pointed out last week, I think, has some serious issues associated with it. Anybody interested in this can Google this, and you know, you'll find a lot of blogging and tweeting going on about it, because I think in the scientific community, there's a feeling that, first of all, if you look at the way the animals that they worked with were generated, they were generated using a very unconventional use of the CRISPR technology that might itself have been inclined to induce undesired DNA changes. Also, I think it's interesting that they published the work in a non-peer-reviewed fashion. So you have to ask yourself, why would they want to do that, especially with something potentially as explosive and important as this? And if you look at the statistics in the paper, I think there's some serious questions about the way they did the study. So I can't really say we can draw many conclusions or maybe any conclusions from those data. I think it just is a reminder that we need to continue to evaluate this technology going forward.
Chinese scientists have already conducted studies on embryos using CRISPR. Can we create a global consensus on where to draw the line? Or should we be doing that? Or should we just let the scientists do what they think is right?
I think we have to try to create a global consensus. I've been a very active proponent of this. We had a first meeting that was organized by a group I'm involved in the Bay Area called the Innovative Genomics Institute that was organized a meeting in early 2015 to discuss this question. And since then, there now have been multiple meetings, including in Washington at the end of 2015, sponsored by the National Academies of Science in the U.S., U.K., and China, to, you know, really figure out, can we come together as a scientific community and make some recommendations and also have some agreements about how we will and won't use this technology. And I think that's been a productive thing. I think it's very hard to think about putting regulations in place globally. How would you enforce such things? I think it's very hard. But no. I think having a group of scientists who are highly respected, who have deeply evaluated this technology and come together to make a statement is powerful.
Let me go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Jim in Decatur, Georgia. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi. I have a son who has a chromosome gap on chrome 10. And for your research, what is the likelihood of effective treatment for those specifically that have gaps in chromosome sequences?
Well, hi, Jim. Thanks for calling in. So I think, you know, what we're finding right now with the technology is that it's a lot easier to remove DNA sequences than to replace them or insert new ones. That's very much at the cutting edge of the technology. And I'm very optimistic in the future about the potential to do that. But I think right now that's still an area of very active development in the field.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you write about the possibilities of gene editing through the story of a patient named Kim who had hereditary disease just disappear. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's right. That's Right. I mean, there's some incredible stories, you know, clinically about the changes that can happen in DNA. And wouldn't it be great if someday we can do that in a very directed way?
You also talk about, I was very struck by you making a specific point. You talk about scientists as poor communicators to the public of the consequences and details of your work. Tell me more about this and your own evolution of your thought and understanding that scientists like yourself, if they're going to inform, if the public is going to be informed about new research, they need to get out and talk with people.
I think it's critical, you know, and I really speak from my own personal experience. I mean, I think it's been, you know, very much a process for me to figure out how to talk about science and talk about the, you know, technical aspects of work that we're doing and that other people are doing in a way that is not off-putting or completely just unintelligible to you know, to non-scientists. And I think that in general, in my own experience, both be, you know, as a student going through the educational system and then now as an educator, that we don't really train our students and our colleagues to talk about our work outside of the scientific community. This needs to change because I think it's really critical, especially now with the pace of new technologies coming along, for there to be active engagement between scientists and the rest of the world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with the author, Jennifer A. Doudna, with she was co-writer with Samuel Sternberg of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. And I must say, as you talk about communicating to the public, this is an incredibly well-written and understandable book on CRISPR. And I just a great little reference. And you get into all the issues about CRISPR. And we get tweets. We have a couple of tweets in from Bruce Kaufman. Please define the acronym CRISPR-Cas9. What does it mean?
Okay, it stands for, get ready, clusters of regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. A big mouthful. And what does it mean? Well, it means it really refers to a sequence pattern, a pattern of DNA sequences in the chromosome of bacteria that is the hallmark of a bacterial immune system.
Incredible. I mentioned before the Chinese have already conducted studies on embryos. Do you doubt that there will soon be a baby born somewhere with CRISPR?
I think it's coming. I can't tell you when, but I think this is something that, you know, it's in our future. And this is why it's so critical right now to be grappling with all of the various issues around such a thing.
Mm-hmm. You write that the overarching takeaway from the book is, quote, humans need to keep exploring through open-ended scientific research. But obviously you're saying there should be some limits on the open-endedness of that.
Well, or at least the applications of it, right? I think, you know, to forge ahead without thought about the consequences of one's work is just irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. I remember back at the Asilomar conference, I remember covering that back in the 70s and with Paul Berg. Do you feel like we're at that moment now?
Absolutely. You know, and Paul Berg and David Baltimore, two of the scientists who were involved in those early discussions around the ethics of molecular cloning, have been incredibly helpful in thinking through the ethical challenges with gene editing.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you like to see happen now?
Well, I think that, you know, encouraging scientists and the rest of the world to embrace this technology for what it can do and to move ahead with the opportunities to use it to solve real human problems is great and should be encouraged. At the same time, I think we have to continue to have a very active discussion about appropriate use of this technology and encourage responsible activities around the world.
Because you can get your own home kit now, CRISPR kit, can't you?
You can.
All right. We'll leave it there with Jennifer Doudna, professor of chemistry and molecular and cell biology, UC Berkeley, co-author of a really good book. If you want some summer reading, it's a quick read, even though it's got some nice technical stuff in it. A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing, and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. Thank you, Dr. Doudna, for taking time to be with us today.
Great to talk to you, Ira.
You're welcome. After the break, general relativity predicted it, but Albert Einstein called the experiment impossible. And now the impossible has been done, and it involves weighing a star using the light-bending ability of mass in space. A really interesting stuff, how to weigh a star with gravity. Coming up after the break, stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Scientists have now completed a test of general relativity that Einstein said would be impossible. And the success allows astronomers to do something new, and that's weigh a star. Let me go back and retrace a bit. Back in 1915, Einstein's theory of general relativity predicted that stars, being massive, would warp space. And that theory was tested successfully during the solar eclipse of 1919 using the sun as the test star. But Einstein said it would be impossible to make this observation on a star outside of our solar system. Well, 100 years later, a team of astronomers has done just that, measuring the bending of light around a distant white dwarf star. And in doing so, they verified a method with which you can calculate its gravitational force and therefore its mass. Voila, you can weigh the star. How hard was this? Well, here to tell us all about it is my guest, Kailash Sahu. He's an astronomer with the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. He's the lead author on the research. Also, Mario Livio, an astrophysicist and author also based in Baltimore. Welcome back to Science Friday, Mario. Good to meet you, Dr. Sahu.
My pleasure.
Good to be with you, Ira.
Thank you, Mario. Dr. Sahu, explain this process a bit more thoroughly than I did. How can bending light give us a mass of a star, and exactly what did you accomplish on this?
You explained, you gave a very nice introduction. So you said that Einstein said it was not possible. So I would like to give a little analogy of how difficult it is. So this particular project, you know, the measuring the deflection caused by a white dwarf, the deflection itself is about 1,000 times smaller than what Eddington measured. Eddington measured more 1.75 arc seconds, and this is 2 milli arc seconds. And that, so to give you an example, 2 milli arc seconds, what we are measuring is, imagine a U.S. quarter in New York, as an Imperial State Building, and so a firefly is crawling across that U.S. quarter from one end to the next, one end to the other. And right next to that, there is a bright light bulb, and your job is to measure that firefly's motion from one end to the other from Kansas City, about 1,500 miles away. So, yes, Einstein thought it was impossible, but we were able to do that. So this gives actually a very new method to measure the mass of a star. So the principle is very simple. So as the there is a massive body, then the light gets bent, and so that causes a slight deflection, the displacement of the background star. So if a foreground star comes very close to a background star, then the background star's light gets slightly displaced by the amount that I just described, and that displacement is directly, it's tells you directly what the mass of this foreground star is. It's like putting you on a scale, and just the movement of the scale just tells your weight similar. This is exactly like that. You just measure the deflection, and that tells the mass. It also depends, of course, on the distance, mm-hmm. because the angle depends on the distance. But once you know the distance, the deflection just tells you the mass. It's a very direct method of measuring the mass.
Very elegant. Mario, was this experiment more a test of Einstein or of our theories about star mass?
Well, at some level, of course, it tests Einstein's general relativity, if that still needed testing, because, you know, we have had many tests of general relativity. To me, as a theorist, I think the importance of this particular observation is twofold. One is, as Kailash pointed out, it's an entirely new method for determining masses of stars, for weighing stars, basically. And this is very important, because until now, the methods we had always depended either on models, or you had to have stars in binary systems, two stars. This allows you to determine the mass of single stars, in principle, you know, of black holes, of neutron stars. And in particular, there is a mission by the European Space Agency called Gaia, which, you know, is supposed to determine the positions and motions of maybe a billion stars. So this will allow for hundreds or maybe, you know, a thousand instances in which you will be able to use this method and determine masses of stars directly. So that's one point. The second point is that in this particular experiment, Kailash and his collaborators determined that this white dwarf star, they determined its mass and its radius, and thereby they could test the relation, the theoretical relation between the radius and the mass of a white dwarf. And that is extremely important because, for example, I'm sure you know that, you know, astronomers discovered that the expansion of our universe is speeding up. It's accelerating. That discovery was made by using some types of stellar explosions called supernova explosions. And those are explosions of white dwarfs of the type that was measured here. Now, if they discovered a different mass-radius relation, this would not have disproved the expansion, the accelerating expansion of the universe. But it would have shown that the objects that do the explosions, the white dwarfs, that we don't understand them, which to me as a theorist would have been extremely disturbing. So by confirming this relation between mass and radius, they have shown that both our theories of stellar evolution and of the theory of white dwarfs are both correct.
Very interesting.
So if I can add to that a little bit, is that okay?
Yes, sure, certainly.
So this particular one, you know, was this particular white dwarf was interesting. So what we did was to actually show that as a method, we took all the stars, all the high proper motion nearby stars, because nearby, because once it is nearby, the star is close by, then it's easier to measure the deflection. And high proper motion, there are a few high proper motion. High proper motion allows that the probability of that it will come close to another star is higher. So we looked for, we proactively looked for all future events. And this particular one we chose, there are several other events. In fact, Proxima Centauri would be our next. But this particular one we chose because this is very interesting. This is effectively an isolated white dwarf. So to measure the mass of a isolated, it's also in a binary, but effectively isolated in the sense its binary companion is more than 55 astronomical units, 5 billion miles apart. So there is no mass transfer. So it's effectively a isolated one. So to measure that and to put it in theory, that was very important. And the other aspect is this particular one had a lot of controversy in the sense people had used this binary, even though it's a wide binary of 3,000 years orbital period, they had used this to get the mass, and that mass was very small, which did not fit in the mass-radius relation, and that would imply the age to be almost the age of the universe. So that was a bit uncomfortable. So we measured using this technique, and it fell right exactly on the mass-radius relationship that was expected. That was a nice confirmation of the theory.
It's always good to have your theory confirmed by the evidence, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. And by the way, Ira, there was one amusing fact that I would like to add, which is, you know, of course, this is a confirmation of Einstein theory. Einstein in German means a stone, and this particular system is called Stein 2051b, just a coincidence that, you know, the word stone appears in both.
I like that. Yes. I like that.
Stein happens to be the, you know, he was a Dutch priest who was working till the age of 78. He was, at the 78, he was still observing stars until he was no more able to move the eyepiece. He was a pretty amazing man. Right. He discovered this.
It's amazing discovery yourself. You guys, Kailash and your whole team deserve great credit for coming up with this and We thank you for taking time to be with us today and sharing that that journey with us.
Thank you.
Kailash Sahu, astronomer for the Space Telescope Science Institute and lead author of this paper discovering this new bending of the weighing of the star. Mario Livio, an astrophysicist and author in Baltimore. Always good to have you two on, Mario. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yet again, we have found another exoplanet. And if you were hoping to live there, not such a good idea. It's 4,600 Kelvin. That's the heat. It's the hottest. Well, it's hotter than most stars, and it's the hottest exoplanet we have found to date. And no life as we know it could survive in that furnace. Even the molecules there would melt into atoms. So it's sort of a gassy planet. That's just a fact of life on KELT-9b, an exoplanet twice the size of Jupiter, and as I say, the hottest planet found to date. And writing for Nature this week, astronomers describe a planet stuck close to its bright, massive star and blasted by intense radiation to the point where it may actually be slowly melting away. Here to take us on a quick tour of this hellish landscape is my guest, Scott Gowdy, professor of astronomy at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, and co-author of the research. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
This has got to be like a set up to a joke, you know? How hot is it, you know?
it's pretty unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, I could imagine this being the punchline to a joke. It was certainly kind of a punch in the gut when we discovered this planet and finally confirmed that it was real. In fact, for many years, I mean, we found the first signal of this planet back in 2014, and it has taken us almost 3 full years to confirm it and finally publish it. So it's, and part of that was just because we had a hard time believing what we had found.
So how does a planet get so hot and in, you know, such a high intensity and so close to its sun?
Well, so I'll answer the last part in a little bit. How did it get so close to its star? That's a question we don't really have a good answer to, although we have some theories. Why is it so hot? Well, two reasons mainly. One is because the host star itself is extremely hot. The host star itself is what astronomers call an A star. So A stars that you may have heard of are Vega and Sirius and Altair. They're stars that have temperatures of roughly 10,000 degrees Kelvin. And because they're so hot, they're extremely luminous. That means they put out a lot of photons per second. And they also tend to be very put out very high energy radiation. So they would appear, and they do appear, if you go out and look in this night sky at Vega or Sirius, they appear blue to our eyes. So this host star is putting out a lot of radiation, and then that's compounded by the fact that the planet is on a very short orbit. It's only about 1.5 days, so its year is about 36 of Earth hours, and it's only about 3 stellar radii from its parent star. And then finally, the planet is so close to its parent star that it is tidally locked. That means that similar to our moon is to the Earth. That means that one side of the planet is always facing the star, and the other side of the planet is facing the cold night. And so that one side of the planet is constantly being bombarded by this intense high-energy radiation from its host star, and that raises the dayside temperature of this planet up to only a few thousand degrees cooler than the sun and hotter, as you say, than most stars.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Scott Gowdy, astronomy professor at Ohio State University, who said he got felt a punch in the gut when he discovered KELT-9b. Does that mean the other side is really cold, while this one side is melting, the other side's freezing?
Well, this is an excellent question. We don't know entirely, but our guess is that the other side, the night side of the planet, is much cooler than the day side of the planet. And that it's probably not zero, because the planet, obviously we know from our from our elementary physics that if you put something hot next to something cold, the heat likes to travel from hot to cold. So the planet is trying its best to create a uniform temperature, but unfortunately it's radiating at such a high rate that it's unable to do so. So the day side really is much hotter than the night side. The night side is still pretty hot. It's the temperature of, say, red dwarfs, so still the temperature of a star, but several thousand degrees likely cooler than the day side. That's a hypothesis, though, but it's one that we can test using the Spitzer Space Telescope, and we hope to.
Can you learn anything useful from studying such like a rogue planet like this?
Sure. I mean, I think whenever you find these extremes that nature provides for us, it helps test our theories. So I'll give you a quick example of this. When I first found this discovery, I talked to a friend of mine, Jonathan Fortney, at University of California, Santa Cruz, and asked him to model it. He's an expert at modeling these kinds of highly irradiated giant planets. And he wrote back to me a few hours later and said that this system actually broke his code. His code crashed because it was so extreme. So when we find these extreme systems, they test our understanding of the physics. And sometimes the physics works and we gain more confidence. Sometimes our codes break, and so we have to go back to the drawing board re-study the physics of these systems.
I bet you love that part of it. This is so fascinating, Dr. Gowdy. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. We're going to follow this a little more, okay?
Okay, great.
I'll have you back to talk more about it. Scott Gowdy, astronomy professor at Ohio State University and co-author of this paper on KELT 9b. That's about all the time we have for today. And if you're looking for something to listen to this weekend, check out our new Science Friday podcast. It's called Undiscovered. It goes behind the scenes of scientific discovery. And this week, you've heard the phrase 6 degrees of separation. Well, in the 90s, two outsider mathematicians unpacked the math behind that meme.
I wonder if it's true. I wonder if you could prove that it's true. And I wonder if it matters.
Are you just 6 handshakes away from every other person on Earth? The answer is on the latest episode of Undiscovered. You can subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Music, or wherever you get your audio podcasts. That's all. That's it. That's our Undiscovered podcast up there on our website, or just download it wherever you get your podcasts. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of City University of New York. And have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.